Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give and then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
Former White House National Security Advisor Michael Flynn today entered a federal courtroom and pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his conversations with the Russian ambassador about Obama-era sanctions just before the inauguration last year. And Flynn has agreed to cooperate with FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian election interference and possible Trump collusion with it.
And then there are the tax cuts.
Right.
So let's get right to it with our Friday roundtable. Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News anchor. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
And Rick, I want to start with you because your colleague at ABC News, Brian Ross, is reporting that Michael Flynn is prepared to testify that President Trump directed him to make contact with the Russians. Tell us more about what we know there.
This is a game changer, and it leads Director Mueller's probe to the doors of the Oval Office itself. We have previously known about Russian contacts between Trump associates and aides and officials. And of course, the guilty plea today is Michael Flynn saying that he was, in fact, in touch with the Russian ambassador, which we knew. But if Flynn is going to tell Mueller and the special counsel's office that he was told by Trump to make contact with the Russians, that has a potential, opens up a whole door to a new level of complications and legal liabilities for this White House.
Well, let's remember, because people can be forgiven for forgetting with everything that's going on. Michael Flynn served in Iraq and Afghanistan, then in the Obama administration. He was pushed out. The Obama administration says they warned Trump about him. He led the lock her up chants on the trail. His son Michael fueled conspiracy theories online. He resigned the Trump administration after just 24 days when it was revealed he'd misled the vice president about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. He also failed to disclose money he received from Russia-linked companies and the Turkish government. He only recently registered as a foreign agent. And we remember President Trump asked then FBI Director James Comey before firing to stop investigating Flynn. Maria Elena, hasn't this smelled for a while?
Yes. And, you know, now it really seems clear that lying to the vice president was just an excuse to get rid of him. They had to find a way to get rid of him. You know, now there's two people admitting that they lied to the FBI, Papadopoulos and Flynn.
And
so that raises the question of...
Well, you mentioned Papadopoulos. You should remind people again, it's so hard to keep track, but he was sort of the more low-level campaign aide who, in that famous now photograph with Sessions and Trump at a table, offered to set up meetings with the Russians.
Yeah, and it gets a little delicate because we remember that picture, that famous picture where Trump was there with Papadopoulos and Kelly, and they all say they don't remember. And Sessions was there, and he said he doesn't remember. So, you know, it seems that now is maybe the time where Trump needs to begin to worry. Now that it was reported that Flynn's lawyers stopped communicating with White House lawyers, you know, it makes you wonder if there was a plea deal. And it seems by what Rick Klein is reporting that there was some kind of a plea deal where Flynn will spill the beans. So, you know, what we're seeing here is a pattern from the president that when you are in a sticky situation, you just deny it. You pretend it didn't happen. You know, he doesn't admit to anything about Russia contacts, just like he doesn't admit to any of the sexual harassment allegations against him.
So, Rick, where does this go now?
The question of what story Michael Flynn has to tell becomes critical now, because his lawyer has said in the past that he has quite a story to tell. And I think how close it gets to the president, what Mueller learns from this, I think for a lot of people, they look at the guilty plea today and say it was very narrow. So it suggested that he brought a lot to that table. I feel like now the investigation goes into hyperdrive, and anyone who was hoping for it to wind down is seeing that it's really closer to the beginning than the end.
All right. A lot more going on in Washington today, and I want to talk about tax cuts. We may get a vote today. Maria Elena Salinas, as you watch this, what do you think? Is the Republican tax cut plan going to be able to pass?
Yeah, it's interesting how such there could be such a different point of view on this tax plan. You know, sort of like, is the glass half full or the glass half empty? You know, but aside from who will benefit and who will be hurt by this, it's definitely more about the politics of it. And I think that's what's on their mind. You know, before positions on immigration, abortion, same-sex marriage, the flag, Confederate status, before all that defined the difference between Democrats and Republicans, it was taxes. So now, leading up to the midterms, you know, this vote can determine the political future of members of Congress. And the stakes for Trump are even higher. You know, he's had a tough time getting his agenda through, and now he's realizing that you can't make promises that you can't keep if you don't have control over
them. Well, Rick Klein, it is also a matter of math, isn't it? And we had the report come out late yesterday afternoon, a bipartisan committee on taxation report saying that actually the Republican tax plan would raise the deficit by more than $1 trillion. And, you know, you take different elements of the plan that we're being told we're actually going to, you know, reduce the deficit or to make people's lives better. And now people are suddenly looking back. We're reading in the Boston Globe today about, for instance, take one piece, the move to cut corporate taxes to encourage corporations to bring back profits they've stashed overseas to avoid the taxes. It's been tried before. There was George Bush's tax holiday in 2004 when over $2 trillion was overseas. But a 2010 study showed only $300 billion came back. 92% of that went right into stocks and dividends, even though that wasn't supposed to be allowed in the law. Historically, this hasn't worked. Is there a sense that a lot of what's been sold in these plans is falling apart?
This is a monumental gamble by the Republican Party. We don't know much of the analysis about it, and tax law is so complicated. It has such huge implications. It takes years, sometimes decades, to understand what things mean, and they are literally making laws on the fly or making policy changes on the fly. And I think that their big gamble here is that this is going to provide, as President Trump says, rocket fuel to the economy, that the middle-class taxpayers will see a big benefit. We know for a fact that the deficit's going to take a big hit. We know for a fact that the economy is doing very well right now without this tax. And we know for a fact that most of the benefits are going to go to wealthy people. So this is a tough political battle and an economic gamble as well. And I don't know that Republicans are quite grasping that, because what's overtaken them is the overriding sense that they just need to pass something.
Well, in fact, some on the left, the economists, are refusing to call it a tax cut plan. They're calling it a wealth transfer, because they just it feels and, you know, we'll see when the vote comes. But as if there's been sort of a curtain parting, as in The Wizard of Oz, and people are taking a closer look now. But anyway, the tax plan, do we know who's on board, who's not? They've been jockeying all day.
Yeah, and we just got word from Senator Jeff Flake that he is on board. It does appear like they have enough votes to pass this at this stage, because some of the people that are most worried about the impacts on the deficit have come on board. Mitch McConnell says he has the votes, and they're hurtling toward a final passage in the Senate.
But there may be some Republicans that vote against it. We're going to have to see what happens there. Maria Elena, jump
right
in.
Right, and we... Yeah. And we have no idea exactly what that tax plan is going to look like, because they've made so many changes to it to try to convince those that were not on board that we have no idea what the outcome is going to come and what it's going to look like and what concessions they made.
All right. One more story that we have to get to this week, which is the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and these reports that he's basically being pushed out could be very soon. Rick, what's going on there, and are we going to have a new Secretary of State by the end of the year?
I think by the beginning of next year at the earliest. It seems like the writing is on the wall. The message delivered in the pages of the New York Times and other media outlets that the president has this secession plan in place. On one level, not really a surprise. Rex Tillerson is his frustrations have been fairly well publicly documented. But I think the flip side of that is you're talking about someone in Mike Pompeo potentially replacing him, if confirmed by the Senate, who has little experience in this realm and I think would be seen as much closer to the White House. And I think you'd be drawing a lot of the policy inside the White House.
Well, Tillerson had no experience. I mean, it was the first Good time point. Ever that a state head of the State Department had absolutely no experience. And what is the big problem? Because if you look at what he's doing, he's been spending a lot of time reportedly just stripping the State Department, taking it apart, firing people, not filling roles. He is reducing it. Isn't that what the Trump administration wanted?
Well, yes and no. Partly yes, but I think they're also finding complications in trying to get basic things done.
And Maria Elena?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, this public shaming of someone that he seems to be doing that often when he doesn't like them. You know, he put people in these places, in these positions, even if they had no experience, because of loyalty, because he thought that they would be loyal to him and that they would support him in whatever he said. When he realizes that he's not getting that support, then he's got to push him out one way or another and bring in someone else who thinks that will be loyal to him.
But
so he's definitely
the one
putting
who chose
himself.
Them, as you right.
Look,
right.
Actually, Rick, Maria Elena pointed to there's something a little off here. And you write, this isn't normal. You're referring to, it's a week where a president retweeted a far-right British hate group's anti-Muslim videos, got in a fight with our biggest ally, referred to a senator as Pocahontas in front of Native Americans, reportedly is returning to birtherism, privately questioning Obama's citizenship, saying that wasn't his voice on a tape, in which he already said it was. It isn't normal, but does it get worse? We only got about a minute.
Well, I think one concern is that you can see now maybe why the president was concerned and lashing out, that he knew that the Michael Flynn news was coming down and how bad that would be. But I think it's easy to lose perspective on, because President Trump is realigning the stars almost every day. What he is doing is not normal and shouldn't just be widely accepted because he's doing it.
Just a few seconds, Maria Elena. Go for it.
Yeah, I think that what we need to look at here is usually he sticks to one or two topics when he tweets, and he keeps those the whole week. This time he was all over the place tweeting with so many different things. So we have to wonder, is that a way to sort of like distract the attention away from the problems that he knows are coming? Or does he really mean what he's tweeting? You know, this isn't funny anymore.
Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News anchor. Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Thank you both on this already tumultuous Friday. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a renewed effort now to help free a woman who's been incarcerated since 2004 and is now serving a life sentence for killing a man who hired her for sex when she was 16. Now, 29-year-old Cyntoia Brown has been locked up in Tennessee for 13 years. Her lawyers say she was a runaway who was trafficked by a pimp who abused and raped her and forced her into street prostitution. In court, she said she didn't have a choice.
He wasn't going to let me go nowhere. He's telling me to kill me. He knows where my mom lives.
Cyntoia Brown says one night she was sent by her pimp out on the street where 43-year-old Johnny Allen picked her up, brought her to his home, and she says she killed Allen in self-defense. Her lawyers also say Cyntoia had fetal alcohol syndrome, which disrupted her thinking and was caused by her biological mother drinking when she was pregnant with her.
There's not a day that goes by that I don't hate myself for the way that she's ended up. I said, it begins with me. It's ultimately my fault.
That's Cyntoia Brown's biological mother, Georgina, in the 2011 documentary Me Facing Life, The Cyntoia Brown Story, which has been getting more attention lately since the hashtag Free Cyntoia Brown was circulated on social media by celebrities like Rihanna and Kim Kardashian West, who say a 16-year-old might have been seen in 2004 as a prostitute, but today we should view her as a victim of sex trafficking. Filmmaker Dan Berman produced the documentary about Cyntoia and joins us from the University of Southern California, where he teaches journalism. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Robin.
What brought you to Cyntoia Brown?
I gained access to the juvenile justice system in Nashville in 2002 because I was taking on a project looking at juvenile violence. In 2004, when Cyntoia was arrested, I got a call from the public defender's office telling me about a young girl who had just been arrested and who was in their custody. When they gave me the outline of Cyntoia Brown's case, I decided that I would get on a plane that night. And the next morning, I was sitting in the juvenile detention center talking to a young girl who would then start to open up her life and give us insight into what happened to her and what led to her very violent situation.
Well, tell us about, you know, how she came to be a runaway. What's some of her background?
Cyntoia Brown has a past that took us a while to uncover. This is a young girl who, starting at about age 7, was starting to be abused sexually by men and boys until the point where she becomes a runaway at age 16. And when she ends up on the streets, she's looking for protection. She was picked up by this guy by the name of Cutthroat, who pulls her into a motel, is sexually abusing her, raping her, along with his friends. He sends her out onto the streets with a gun in her purse and says, "You better go get some money, and if you don't, I know where your family lives." And she is picked up by a guy who picks her up for sex.
Well, let's hear some of your footage of what happened. She testified in court when she was 16 about this night when she goes home with this man who picked her up, Johnny Allen. And she said that he had showed her his gun collection, and this made her nervous. Let's listen.
If he does something to me, I'm sitting here thinking, what can I do? I'm in his house. Ain't nobody gonna know where I'm at. My mom and them, they don't know where I'm at. The people that I stay with, check on them, they don't know where I'm at. Nobody's gonna know what happens to me. Cut, he doesn't care. He doesn't even know who I left with. And all this is just running through my mind, and I'm just a nervous wreck.
She says that the man, Alan, reached under the bed where the guns were, and she got frightened and took that pistol that Cutthroat, the pimp, gave her and shot him. Look, we are now learning, because of your documentary and now the new response to Cyntoia Brown, that anyone under 18 in the U.S. involved in commercial sex for sale is considered to be trafficked. So how did she end up with a life sentence with no possibility for parole for 51 years when she was just 16 and being trafficked when this happened?
Sex trafficking was not the word of the day in 2004 when Cyntoia was arrested. Prostitution was. What would have happened in 2004, had she been tried in a juvenile system, she would have been released by age 19. So the juvenile court's choice was to put her into an adult court. For a juvenile, because of how the federal and state laws work, she has to be eligible for parole at some point. So there's a reduction that makes it possible for her to be released at 51 years.
Well, your documentary brought attention to the case. Some say this renewed interest started after a Nashville TV station aired a story just a couple weeks ago. Are you surprised that there's interest again from people like Rihanna and Kim Kardashian? And is she? You're in touch.
It's not surprising to me that this is drawing attention right now, right here, right now. We're at a point in our society where we're starting to ask some very serious questions about sex abuse, where we have predators, powerful people who are preying on women, and it's coming to the forefront in our newscasts on a daily basis. So it's not surprising to me that Cyntoia's story is resonating. It seems natural.
Well, and according to Rights for Girls, which is a nonprofit, as many as 1,000 children are arrested every year on charges of prostitution. And if they're children, one has to assume that there's someone else involved pimping them. And it's common for minors to be charged with these crimes, even though they might be trafficked. But what we're seeing now is new laws. They're called safe harbor laws that might be vacating some of these convictions, taking a second look at charging children with things like, you know, prostitution. 20 states have apparently passed laws making trafficked kids immune from all sorts of crimes. I mean, they're charged with truancy. They're charged with underage drinking. And this is according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, which seems insane, you know, because they're being trafficked, you know, literally held hostage. 29 states have laws to clear the criminal records of trafficking victims for other crimes.
If Cyntoia Brown were arrested today, she would not be charged as a prostitute. She would be considered a young girl who's involved in sex trafficking. Mm. That means that a young girl would, in past years, might have been considered a prostitute. It isn't so, because they're not making that choice, and the laws are reflecting this.
Yeah. So there's the move now to clear, or at least consider, clemency for Cyntoia Brown. There's a MoveOn.org petition online asking the governor of Tennessee to do that. It has more than 400,000 signatures. You are in touch with her. How does she feel about this?
Cyntoia has a very pragmatic approach to all of this. Of course, she wants to be free from prison. But her bigger interest in this whole story has been, and consistently has been, to stop sex trafficking in general. She'd like to see this case have a much bigger impact on how we treat young children. She agreed to do this documentary because at the time when I asked her the question in the very first week that I met her, I know why I'm doing this. Why would you want to do this? Her answer has been and continues to be, if I can keep one child from going down the path that I went down, it will be worth it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is very important here is that we're looking at a young girl who at age 7 is involved in sex. By the time she runs away from home, she has already been exposed to more sex than any child should ever be exposed to.
Sexual abuse.
That's right. Yeah. That's correct. We're looking at sexual predators. Now put her in a situation where she's being repeatedly raped by a bad guy and all of his friends, put her on drugs, and then send her out in the streets with a gun to go get some money. At what point does that girl become a normal person to be judged in an adult system? It just doesn't make sense. This is where our laws are really running awry. Mm. This is not a normal kid. This is not a normal circumstance. And you cannot put a child in an adult system and expect them to be or behave as adults.
Well, we should say that obviously her defense lawyers agree with you. The prosecutor, of course, still maintains that the most important person in this story is the man that she killed.
It is depressing, but there are juveniles from whom society and this community has to be protected. Now, we all have our own opinions, I think, of where that line is drawn, where we stop trying to treat and rehabilitate this child and start imprisoning this child. Where's that line to be drawn? Sometimes it's a tough call.
But what are the paths open to her?
As arrested, as sentenced, her only opportunity in front of her is to serve out a full 51 years as long as she's a model prisoner. Otherwise, she would have to serve 60 years, which is the full extent of her sentence. Mm-hmm. Option number two is for her attorneys to make the case to an appeals court that her trial was not conducted properly and that she should be considered to be retried. Option number three, which is the case that her attorneys and legislators in Tennessee are working on, is a package to be presented to the governor for possible clemency. If all of those fail, the last option really becomes a pathway for the attorneys to take this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And again, that's with a new appeal.
That would be a long process. To move a case from appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court takes a very, very big burden of proof for the attorneys to make, to ask that the U.S. Supreme Court hear the case. So that would be years away.
Yeah. Look, Dan Berman, again, you made the 2011 documentary, Me Facing Life, the Santoya Brown story. We'll link people to it. But we know you're also making another documentary to continue to follow this story. How do you think it's going to end?
It could be that Santoya walks out of prison. It could be that the governor denies clemency. It could be that she goes to an appeals process and the appeal is granted. Our end for this story happens when we can gain clarity about the direction for the story with Santoya Brown.
It's Dan Berman, the filmmaker behind the 2011 documentary Me Facing Life, the Santoya Brown story, working on the sequel. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
NCAA championships in women's soccer take place this weekend in Kansas City. Top-ranked and unbeaten Central Missouri will play in the Division II title game, but the team has been fighting another battle affecting women's soccer everywhere. Players sidelined because of concussions. Greg Eklund from member station KCUR explains.
Had Emily Franchette been healthy, she would have been a senior midfielder for what has shaped up as the best season ever at Central Missouri, but she had to quit the game last year after suffering her fourth concussion. Her first came 6 years ago in high school, and its symptoms linger.
The first one, with all of them, it's hard to kind of remember.
Now, Franchette says something as simple as checking her text messages is an arduous task.
I would try to pick up my phone, you know, and maybe scroll through Twitter or scroll through text messages or something, and the scrolling would make me dizzy because of the movement of the words and stuff. Yeah, because it all just goes way too fast.
Franchette's situation falls in line with the results of a study done at Northwestern University. Researchers there found at the high school level, only football has a higher rate of concussions than girls' soccer. There were 9.4 concussions for every 10,000 times an athlete either practices or plays in a game. The concussion rate for high school girls' soccer isn't far behind, 9.1. At Central Missouri, women's soccer players take a preseason baseline test for memory. Coach Lewis Theobald says if players have concussion symptoms during games or practice, the first step is get them off the field.
The coaches are out of any decision-making for that, and they have to pass the test, and then there's a 5-day to 7-day period where they slowly work back up to full contact, you know, full soccer practices.
Head injuries in women's soccer occur for a variety of reasons. One, having a fast-moving ball hit you in the head. Another, headers, when two players go up to hit a ball in the air with their heads and they collide. Franchette says she made a conscious effort not to use her head to control the ball.
My coaches would even actually yell at me if I would try to head the ball, because it becomes instinctual as a soccer player. You know, you go up to make contact with the ball.
It's an injury found at all levels of the game. Professional soccer player Abby Wambach had a concussion 4 years ago when struck in the head by a ball. An errant ball off the head is how Emily Franchette's career ended, in a preseason practice before her junior year.
It shook my brain up so much that I got vertigo and couldn't see anything. Basically, everything was white, and that had never happened to me before.
This season, another Central Missouri player went down with a concussion. Mallory Brody, a freshman from Omaha, missed games late in the season. If there's one thing Franchette would say to players, it's...
Take what the doctors say and don't take it lightly. Actually do it.
Franchette says giving up soccer was the most difficult decision of her life. She has moved on as an arts major, but says she will be rooting for her old teammates in this weekend's Division II title game. For Here and Now, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
What happens now on the TV shows that starred people who have been fired for allegations of sexual misconduct? Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
And let's start with House of Cards. Here's a clip.
The identity of the next president of these United States is once again in the hands of a bunch of self-serving, money-hungry, boot-licking, power-seeking politicians who can be seduced or sucker-punched or blackmailed into submission. And all I need is just one more vote than the other guy. As you can see, the Founding Fathers didn't plan for this. But I did. Meet your new daddy.
That is actor Kevin Spacey, of course, as President Underwood. I know, it takes on a whole new meaning.
That's incredibly creepy.
Yeah. Well, and Spacey, as we know, has been fired from his starring role after multiple accusations of sexual harassment and assault. The sixth and final season of the show is still expected to premiere next year without Spacey's character. How is the show going to deal with that?
Well, it's interesting. So first, a massive spoiler alert. Anyone who hasn't watched all of season 5 of House of Cards, be warned that we're going to talk about how that season ends. And how that season ended was in an interesting place where Spacey's character, Frank Underwood, was president, but he was facing possible impeachment and investigation from a congressional committee. So he agreed with his wife to resign the presidency, let her take over as president, and then the idea was that she was going to pardon him so they didn't have to worry about any sort of investigations. And his idea was that he could get more power in the private sector and also collude with his wife, who would then be president. But in the final scenes, you know, they've been having trouble with their relationship, and she was reconsidering whether or not she was going to pardon him. So this actually leaves the House of Cards producers with a few different decisions. They could decide to have Underwood impeached and going to jail off camera. They could decide to have him befall some sort of fate and kill off the character, or have him facing some sort of prosecution and deciding to leave the country or something like that. But it's interesting that they sort of position the series where they could center the storylines on Robin Wright's character, Claire Underwood, without changing very much of what had happened before. You know, the series was kind of positioned to shift and focus on her more anyway. And that may be one reason why they have decided that they can keep doing the show.
But is it really possible, Eric, for them to keep doing the show without Kevin Spacey's character?
I do think it's possible for them to do a final season. I think it's going to be hard to have his character be present in the show at all. So how do you disappear Kevin Spacey's performance and yet provide something that feels like House of Cards and that is compelling? Now, frankly, I think a lot of people are going to watch just to see what they come up with. But I don't think it's necessarily impossible, because Robin Wright has proven that Claire Underwood's character is compelling and she can be just as ruthless as Frank Underwood was.
And do you think we'll see his face?
Boy, I would imagine we'd have to see it. You know, particularly if he dies, they would have to have like a photo of him or something like that. But other than that, I don't think we're going to see him.
What about Amazon's Transparent? Jeffrey Tambor plays Maura Pfefferman, the trans woman at the center of the show. Here she is talking about dealing with her homophobic sister.
Well, was she at least cordial to you?
No. Is a lizard cordial? She's a filing cabinet with a hairdo. I mean, she hated me when I was male, and you know, when she was little, she used to accuse me of wearing her clothes.
Did you?
Of course I did.
So Tambor has been accused of harassment by two women he worked with on the show. He's called the accusations baseless, but still announced that he's leaving his role. No official word from Amazon about whether the show will move forward. But showrunner Jill Gordon has said there's momentum from inside to continue without Tambor. What might happen here?
So I think it would be hard to continue this show without the Maura Pfefferman character in some way, because the entire heart of the show is this idea that Jeffrey Tambor's character had been hiding his true gender from everyone in his life, or most people in his life, for most of his life, and that had very severe consequences on his marriage, on his children, on their views of gender and sex and secrets. It's very much about family secrets. Now, I think one thing that could work here even better than in House of Cards might be the death of the character. If Maura were to pass away, there could be a whole season centered on the family sort of trying to cope with the death of the Maura Pfefferman character. And in the last season, we saw flashbacks to when Maura was younger and was publicly identifying as male, and a different actor was playing the character. So you could have flashbacks using that actor. And there had been some talk about trying to cast a trans actress in the role, something that some people felt should have been done from the beginning anyway. But I do think it would feel a bit gimmicky to take an existing role and cast it with a different actress at this point in the show. And it might be better to kill the character off and let the characters cope with the loss, or even have perhaps Maura just decides to leave, run away, go somewhere, and never have contact with her family again.
Jeffrey Tambor is also a star of Arrested Development, which Netflix has been producing recently. Do you think that show is going to continue?
Well, I think that would be hard to know. There haven't been any allegations that he's done anything on that set. And Netflix has responded differently to different allegations. They acted quickly regarding Kevin Spacey, but there have been allegations about Danny Masterson, who's an actor on a comedy called The Ranch that they do. They don't seem to have reacted much to that publicly yet. They haven't shut down production or removed him from the show. So it's hard to know. I haven't spoken to anyone at Netflix about what they might do about Arrested Development, but that's certainly something they're going to have to address at the very least.
Finally, Eric, we have to talk about morning television. Charlie Rose fired by CBS after eight women came forward accusing him of harassment. And then, of course, Matt Lauer this week fired by NBC News, allegations against him as well. What are these two morning shows going to do, CBS This Morning and The Today Show?
I mean, what's sort of astonishing about this is that, you know, Matt Lauer was the king of morning television, arguably the most powerful and perhaps best paid TV personality in TV news. And there's been this highly competitive battle between The Today Show and Good Morning America for ratings and for profit. And Good Morning America has more total viewers, but The Today Show has more viewers that advertisers like, viewers aged 25 to 54. So theoretically, it probably makes more money. CBS was about to be a contender and break in, and it was getting some of the best ratings in the morning it had seen in a long while, with Charlie Rose as part of a three-person team. Now he's gone. And the thing about CBS is they don't have much of a bench in terms of male anchors. So the people who've been filling in that we've seen, they're great journalists, but they don't have the profile. They're not near the profile of a Charlie Rose. And Page Six, the gossip sheet, had a story saying that CBS wanted Oprah to fill in at least part-time. She's a contributor on 60 Minutes, and she's friends with Gail King, right, one of the co-anchors on The Morning Show. I doubt that's going to happen, but that's, you know, that's the kind of casting about they have to do for a successor there. At NBC, they've always had a policy of having redundancy among their anchors more. So you have Willie Geist, who's ready to step in.
Right.
You have Carson Daly, who could step in. You have Al Roker, who could step in. And frankly, I'd like to see them go far afield. I mean, Michelle Norris, somebody who did a great job on All Things Considered and once worked in television. I'd love to see her on CBS. And maybe have three women leading that show. Anderson Cooper is somebody who makes a lot of sense if it's possible for him to do, because he was a contributor on 60 Minutes. Now, here's the thing that might really be interesting. There's been some talk about Brian Williams, and he is, of course, very tarnished. I would wonder, because the head of NBC News right now is a friend of his, if they might not have somebody like Willie Geist to replace Lauer short-term and try to figure out a way to slowly introduce Brian Williams as the male anchor and get people used to the idea of seeing him again, because he's been hosting an 11 p.m. show on MSNBC. That's a long shot, and I think the reaction to that might be really harsh, but it's an interesting idea, and I wonder if they might not try it if they were desperate.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump tweeted today that the not guilty of murder verdict in the trial of an illegal immigrant accused of shooting Kate Steinle on a San Francisco pier in 2015 is evidence of the danger of illegal immigrants, a travesty of justice, build the wall. The jury found Garcia Zarate guilty of possession of a gun but not guilty of murder. They decided he did not mean to shoot Steinle when the gun went off, ricocheted off the ground, and then ultimately hit her. Scott Schaefer is covering the Steinle case for KQED in San Francisco. And Scott, this case was emotionally and politically fraught. Zarate was in the country illegally. He'd been deported 5 times. But wasn't it always a hard case to make because the bullet did hit the ground?
You're absolutely right, Robin. As you said, prosecutors charged him with murder and manslaughter in the day of the death of Kate Steinle. But, you know, the prosecution just didn't really have the evidence. They tried to make the case that this was a deliberate firing of the gun in the victim's direction, that he knew he was firing the gun, and it was aimed at her general direction. But as you say, the bullet hit him, hit the ground about 12 feet from where he was, ricocheted about 80 feet down the pier and hit Kate Steinle. So the defense said this was a terrible inadvertent accident. You know, he picked up the gun, he found it, accidentally fired it, wasn't aiming it at anybody, and then threw it in the bay.
Yeah.
So the jurors ultimately believed that.
Look, San Francisco Bay. San Francisco is a sanctuary city, meaning officials don't want local police to work with federal immigration officials because it weakens their ability to work with the immigrant community. So residents aren't arrested based just on their immigration status. It's only when they break another law. Remind us how this became such a talking point across the country.
Well, as you said, I mean, Zarate had been deported 5 times, came back into this country. And when this murder occurred, it was July of 2015. The presidential election was heating up. Donald Trump had already been making illegal immigration a big talking point in his campaign. He was talking about building the wall. And so this case of a young woman, by all accounts, a lovely young woman, walking on the pier with her dad, murdered in cold blood, so to speak, but killed by this guy who fired a gun, who wasn't here, who was here illegally, it was tailor-made for his talking points. And so it became a regular talking point on the campaign trail for Trump at the GOP convention. And since then, and as you said, he's been tweeting about it in the last day or so.
Well, by the way, that very much angered at least her brother, Brad, who said in 2015 that President Trump was sensationalizing this to advance his immigration proposals. He told CNN, "He talks about my sister like he knows her. I never heard a word from him. He should ask about our political views, what we want." That was then. Now, as you said, he is tweeting. In fact, he is tweeting and saying that Democrats are going to pay for this because they are so weak on crime. How is this going to play out, do you suspect? How are people responding to it?
Well, I think there is a lot of shock and disbelief that he got off with such a minor conviction, just possession of a firearm for a felon. You know, and he could be out of jail fairly quickly. He'll be deported, but of course he's been deported 5 times before. You know, politically in California, I don't know that it'll have a huge impact, maybe around the margins. I mean, California has dealt with this issue you know, we kind of dealt with it decades ago. I mean, there was a poll that came out just today, 86% of Californians, 86%, so it cuts across all political parties, support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, assuming they don't get in trouble with the law and meet some other, you know, criteria. So there is not a big appetite in California for suddenly building a wall and getting tough on immigrants who are here legally or illegally. So I think it could play out maybe around the margins in the governor's race. We have a candidate, Antonio Villaraigosa, the former Los Angeles mayor, who is taking a little more moderate position on these issues. You know, if he gets into a top two runoff in California's top two primary system, it could be two Democrats facing off in November of next year. You know, that kind of a more moderate position could appeal to moderate voters and maybe some Republicans.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is also weighing in, condemning things like Sanctuary City, saying the death of Kate Steinle, horrible, was preventable. But the shooter did not have previous violent history, so it's unclear, you know, if that claim is true. But meantime, awful. How is her family? How are her friends responding?
Well, you know, the family, of course, is still suffering the daily loss of this beloved daughter, sister, friend, and they chose not to go to the courtroom yesterday when the jury pronounced its verdict. They did do a long interview with the San Francisco Chronicle, in which they said they were, you know, shocked and saddened, but not angry. They said, you know, if he had gone to prison for 100 years, it wouldn't bring their daughter back. They resent the politicization of her daughter, as you suggested earlier. And so I think they want to go back to having a private life, not being the center of attention or focus from the president or anyone else. And they'd like, I think, to stop their daughter from being a talking point on a campaign trail.
Yeah, well, it's not like that's going to happen. Breitbart News, run by former White House advisor Steve Bannon, rate 8 stories on Steinle's murder overnight. And they are hammering home that it was an illegal alien, as they would say, an undocumented immigrant who was found not guilty. So we're probably going to hear from this. Scott Schaefer, yep. Political reporter for KQED in San Francisco, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.